After I had prolonged and enjoyed the folly, fraud, madness, the beginning of the chemistry, mere mysticism, or more recently, as the psychology of the unconscious, the literary scholars have pretty well let it alone. Editors of various state literary works recited alchemical authority. Chemists have sometimes taken a swing at coming up with alchemical ideas that appear in literature and art, now and in the book of series with such a title as Dirk of the Alchemist and Dante Alchemist. And at least in the 12th century, remarks have been made, usually by the alchemists themselves, that the works of Homer, Virgil, and Ovid are merely parables of the great work of transmutation, but the enormous accumulation of manuscripts and books that are obviously alchemical has yet to be investigated by men who make the study of literature their business. To the chemists and technologists who translate old alchemical poems into English verse. C.A. Brown, for instance, best known for his works of the chemistry of sugar, he translated into English verse a long poem of the Greek Archimedes. I quote a few samples from his didactic beginning that recommend study, technical skill, practical experiments. Its middle that describes a series of chemical processes in which the substances are identified merely as body and soul, and part of the conversational embellishment in which the feminine soul speaks to the masculine body. The schoolman really wise in sacred art, so theoretic finds and techniques used with vested energy and force, and shows in learned practice labor's perfect end, for practice is a theory of debate. Exert our mind in contemplation, first of all philosophy, a secret word, and intricate ideas of ancient laws. Then try, assisted by thy technical skill, by wise experiment and judgment too, to know the union of the elements, the numerous qualities, and how to blend by wise intelligence, each one with each, and bind them firmly to the arch of one end, which brings opulence and useful gain. The soul from body only can be received by art that the myriad man must know. Take and remove her from the body's hold, and turns away all blackness hid within that veils her shining loveliness with gloom. A craftsman wise, thou wilt remove this gloom by trituration and by frequent dyes, not being vexed because of many toils, but purify it skillfully and well by guiding it in water most divine. Next calcium it by plunging into fire, remove its rust, make bright again and turns until its earth is lurking like a wave and rises easily to form a cloud borne wholly up and running down in streams. The talking sunrise in her brilliance is seen all things above, no longer yet, as splendor gleams without and from within that overpowers the eyes of those who look. With longing she cries out and takes the sea. She wonders, from her body being freed, how she abides again as spirit-like. She sees outspread a former instrument, all motionless and without speech and life, awaiting resurrection in its tomb. She draws near, and thus across her body's prostrate form. Her voice rings, by signs, though not with words, she says. Come out, arise from Hades' dismal pit. Cast forth from thee the darkness and the gloom. Tear off again the shroud of death, the robe which hitherto has held thee one condemned, in which so many seasons were endured, that thou may show thyself refined throughout, transformed like spirit and revivified by her the soul, who lately rose from thee and who will quickly live in thee again. It goes on considerably after that, but so much for chemist C.A. Brown's translation of Archimedes. It is also chemistry and technologists who point out the literary and poetic beauty of alchemical writing. David Valentine's 12-piece instance is said to intersperse chemical knowledge with beautiful prose filled with exalted expression of philosophy, ethics, and religion. The late Sherwood S. Taylor, one of the founding members of the Society for the Study of Alchemy and Early Chemistry, this enthusiastic is the poetic value of the prose writing. He says of a second century Greek work, this is an intense way of describing some alchemical operations and materials. The author, by writing in this style, conceals the real nature of the process and must be thought to be writing to those who already know it. Why then, I saw. The explanation is, I think, that such a work is in reality a kind of poem, expressing the wonderful analogies that the author sees between the great world and its season, and growth and death and degeneration and the process of the alchemical work. I quote a rare sample from the prose that clearly follows a kind of poem. This is episode 8. Our kings and those with him answered to the paper. He's a lady alchemist, not to be confused with the serpent of the Nile. In thee, they feel the strange and terrible mystery. Enlighten us, casting your light upon the elements. Tell us how the blessed waters visit the corpses lying in Hades, shattered and afflicted in darkness, and how the medicine of life reaches them and rouses them if they awaken by their possessions to see. The apostle said to them, the waters, when they come, awake the bodies and the spirits which are imprisoned in youth. But they again undergo oppression and are imprisoned in Hades, and yet in a little while they grow and rise up, and put on diverse colors like the flowers in springtime, and the spring itself rejoices and is glad at the beauty that they wear. For I tell this to you, you are wise. When you see stones, elements, and stones in their places, they appear to you to be mature. But they are not mature until the fire has tested them. When they are clothed in the glory from the fire, and the shining color thereof, then rather will appear their hidden glory, their sought-for beauty being transformed to divine state of reason, to their nourishing the fire, and the embryo grows little by little, nourishing its mother's beauty. Although we might not agree that Brown's translation of Archelaus is poetry, or with Taylor's definition of a poem, it seems evident that alchemy deserves study as a literary part of our culture, not just as chemistry, nor, as D.G. Jung would have it, as nothing but psychology. The historians of chemistry have performed very scholarly work in the past 70 or 80 years, editing and translating texts, and Jung has delved deep into alchemical literature to back up his claim that alchemy has little or nothing to divulge in the way of chemistry, least of all the secret of gold making. That instead, the alchemists were the first psychologists of the collective unconscious. Although Jung admits that the secret of alchemy, impenetrable to our logic, is essentially unknown, and though he shows himself disposed to coerce the truth to his personal design when he blames the alchemists for mixing up chemistry with their mythological symbolism, he insists that the historians of chemistry should have let alchemy alone, because it is an ideal hunting ground, the real chosen source for the psychology. The real nature of matter, he says, was unknown to the alchemist. He knew it only in him. Inasmuch as he tried to explore it, he projected the unconscious into the darkness of matter in order to illuminate it. Although Jung seems to be projecting his own unconscious or his own prejudice into alchemy, his real knowledge and his great zeal have thrown a mist over the eyes of critics of literature who increasingly accept his world as final. An alchemical image of anybody's form is now related to the psychology of the collective unconscious. And the author of the poem is in great danger of being classified as a schizophrenic, struggling for the synthesis of elemental racial forces at odds with one another in the secret depths of his confused fancy. Although I do not by any means suggest that the historians of chemistry and the psychologists should let out to be alone, I do suggest that serious scholars with a broader point of view make it very clear. Another thing alchemy is a difficult subject written in many languages and in what Robert Boyle called alchemical language, for our wishing to be understood. A compounding of analogies and metaphors that makes most poetry seem unadorned and simple. First, we discovered that the alchemist seems almost impossible nowadays. If we may alone, the 20th century initiates in the adept. He's right when he says that the modern mind admits this difficulty, that one must dedicate 20 or 30 years of his life to a study that may culminate at last in the sun-like triara of the adept. But such, Elo insists, is the royal road of an art that is set the fire itself is from the light born of nature. Further, most scholars would be advanced when at last they have succeeded in the art and remember the solemn adjuration to secrecy that concludes most alchemical work. Would such scholars accept the automatically imposed oath of silence and reveal their findings at the trial? In a careful veil of metaphorical language, or would they follow Sir Isaac Newton's advice to boil to maintain a high silence and keep their discovered secrets to themselves? Another difficulty lies in Alchemy's inclusion of all the philosophies, religions, arts, and sciences known to the Western world. A syncretism much like that of Tiso della Mirandola, who indeed included alchemy in his self-imposed curriculum that led to his definition of the dignity of man. A few passages selected from Robert Fludd's First Golden Carol, written probably in 1623, will give some idea of the astounding syncretism of alchemic thought, and also show that such differences of opinions now exist between chemists and psychologists young are no novelty. Fludd writes to repeat the claim of Patrick Scott, a follower of James I, and sometimes too the Prince Charles, that the alchemists intended no material elixir, but were interested only in moral wisdom. Fludd concludes his summary of Scott's ideas. Lastly, for the better computation or disannulment of a real and material elixir to multiply gold, he, Scott, expresses what the philosophy stone in his conceive is, inferring that it should rather be some secret direction of morality attained to the better exaltation of the inward man after the modest rules of wisdom than that it in any way belongs to or aimed at a material or sensible offshore operation. And to confirm this point, he alludes the chief matter of the elixir, namely the philosopher's mercy, unto the child of heaven, his separation of pounding, beating, or mixing the materials, unto the beating down and qualifying our affections in the mortar of a wise heart. If even it was more or less fire, is the final testing or relaxing of our self-will. The colors give us to understand that the perseverance in virtue will subdue our unruly domestic affections, which, unless they be overcome, pounded, qualified, sublimed, and fixed into a pure kingdom-like white, are ever ready to be bored from the precepts of reason into a soul-killing liberty. Although Fludd takes Scott's argument apart point by point, he's a long time about it. He insults him first by saying that he said the fault is easy. I suspect that this artillery of light will prove that a sophisticated and one who after long suit has been rejected and refused by this fearless lady, the philosopher's virgin elixir, who, because he has been and yet continuous so blind that he could never purchase with all his endeavors, the sight of her bright presence, let me imagine that she is not to be found in realm mystery. He follows the insult of Sargent in the admission that alchemy may indeed deal with morality. But he insists on the materiality of the elixir with a quotation from Job 28, the stones thereof are a place of sapphire, and the dust is of his gold, saying that a more excellent description of the material elixir cannot be made by the wisest alchemist or deepest philosophy. At length he becomes somewhat more explicit, saying that the elixir is composed of a divine spirit and a spiritual body, and being the pattern of Christ risen again, it must needs have the power to multiply infinitely. He continues, You that love it seems strange unto any man that such a power is given to this life, being that it is the branch of the universal emanation from the fountain of life, which was, as Solomon witnesses, present with God when he made all things. And thereupon Orpheus, Democritus, and many of the Pythagoreans could imagine that all things were full of God. Yet nevertheless, such was their respect unto the fountain of all these petty lights, if they had evermore their main relation unto one monarch or sole Jupiter. By the same reason also the Platonists did acknowledge the peculiar solar beam of light to be in every particular and individual creature. But the universal soul of the world is the heaven fountain unto which they all refer, and unto which they refer all those singular lights, as all the beings of heavenly light are issuing and belonging unto one Apollo, one sun. Do not these their opinions jump and meet in one point to this assertion of Holy Scripture? God's incorruptible spirit is in everything. Flood concludes at last with advice to look for a real materialistic, a real mercy of the philosophers, adding, and if it be not your fortune to find it, it seem not your understanding to be more exalted than these, the many authorities of chemistry and otherwise that you have cited, which me that are fit you appear altogether ignorant. Although he gives many hints, Flood never identifies the materialistic in plain words. He is writing the metaphorical tradition imposed, as he says, not only by the alchemists, but by many others as well. God himself in Proverbs 12, Christ who would not that pearls were cast before swine. Mercurius says in Augustus, he calleth his silence the fruitful propagation of goodness. Plato, Pythagoras, Porphyry, Orpheus, Apuleius, St. Paul, the great Rosary of the philosophers, and Thesis Mirandulus. King Flood says, witness was that the custom of the ancients was in the writing of great things, either physical or divine, to do them hiddenly and figuratively, because the rudeness of the hearers, which could not endure the splendor of Moses' doctrine, ought to have doctrine and words with a veiled face, lest such as were to be illuminated to be blinded with too much light. So much to Flood, because Shakespeare himself left the blind anyone with too much light. If I were asked just what I thought the Renaissance scholar might gain by studying alchemy, I should have to answer in God's terms. Perhaps he might discover the fire of Celsus that may be extracted from the light of Mercury in its spiritual, psychological, moral, and material manifestations. He might discover why Homer, Virgil, Ovid, Jean de Mille, Dante, Frost, and Goethe, and others have been classified as alchemists and have it meant to be so classified. He might discover important connections between the alchemists and the general dissemination of knowledge of many kinds. For myself, I found the study of alchemy ever more and more a widening out into a liberal education. Trying to understand our chemical metaphor, I have been studying languages, mythology, philosophy, chemistry, mineralogy, metallurgy, glass making, the physics of light and color, luminescence, the manufacture of artificial precious stones, and poetry. This alchemy may, in some sense, be justly called a kind of poetry. It is reasonable to suppose the force of better ships to understand its metaphorical implications than the general run of medicine. It naturally follows that if a reader knows as much about alchemy as the poet he is studying knows, he will arrive at richer interpretations. As a conclusive example of my own attempt to elucidate a vivid alchemical image in John Webster's The White Devil, Victoria, who is commonly identified with the White Devil of her title, says, in the course of her tormentors when she is being accused of murder and lasciviousness, knows that and let it somewhat raise your spite. In darkness dying, said very wicked light. Webster, notoriously, is a of brilliant images from the works of others might have developed the idea of the diamond shining in the dark in the Faustian account of Lucifer's fall, which says, when he became high-minded, proud, and presumptuous, a translation of Hitler neatly fits the story, he was banished out from amongst the heavenly powers, separated from their abiding, into the manner of a fiery stone that no water is able to quench. Lucifer and Venus may be easily thought of as one, morning and evening star respectively, the characterization that fits the story on the account of her masculine virtue and also a strong alchemical feeling of the alchemical her masculine. Besides, she is repeatedly compared to a blazing star, a comet that bears just sufficiently. In fact, the comet that loses its stone before its light is put out to judge. It would be nice if you accept the Lucifer fire stone that nobody could sense, I feel, without observing that the philosopher's stone is repeatedly described as standing in the dust. But she might have been inspired by the mystical alchemical subject. Your visit is so clear a light on holy science in the dark night, or by a practical recipe described by Paracelsus. This well-polished stick or a pearl, which is certainly interesting, which is certainly an hour that he cares how much that he is, you can't get it, really, I can't get it, becomes a, oh, here's everything. This well-polished stick or a pearl, which is put into it, after certainly an hour for some time, becomes a hyacinth, that is like a hyacinth in all its character and look. Likewise, a ruby, which is not highly graded, and which is put into the red oil for 9 years, becomes so pure and clear, and reaches such a grade that if later it is put in darkness, it gives light like a coal, so that you can see from all around where it is lying. This has been proved by experience. The old alchemist made carbuncle out of it. If they put a good hyacinth into the oil, it would become a green carbuncle. Although Paracelsus talked of hyacinth, ruby, and carbuncle, making no mention of diamonds, other alchemists do speak of diamonds in much the same way. And more often than not, they speak of two stones, the white one and the red one, the white always preceding the red one. For instance, such a stone is rising about 13 feet, as the stone is older than it. Nor would you assume that this art ties genuine in the club of philosophorum. But unless you first make it white, you will not be able to make it red, because the white potentially contains the red. If there will be too little gold in a compound, say it's argon, the paper will be brilliantly white. Alphidius says, know that the vibration must come first, which is the beginning of the holy work, and then the rubrication must follow, which is the perfection of the holy work. Now, I just have to kid him there. This goes on forever, there's just no end to it. But it's obvious to me, it seems, that Victoria is characterized as the philosopher's stone, which the many alchemists use of the author who does value the multi-causes, and also the same ties in with actual technology. Diamonds do shine in the dark. I didn't know that. Borrowed the following from the images, and I came across a picture of one, a photograph taken by a friend of a diamond that's staying in the dark, and it was generated to be so by X-ray. And it is true that artificial precious stones are more likely to have this curious, magic, mystical, heavy, intelligent power of the illumination. And I thank you.
The next paper is by Harry Orwell of the University of Canada. William Groff, the poem of the opening scene of King Lear, was published in a recent issue of Hudson Review. It has more than a passing interest to students of Shakespeare. Mr. Frost argues that the scene can be understood best as allegory or as myth. The story of an ancient king of Britain who had three daughters, of whom two were evil and one was good. All questions of motivation are bypassed at the outset, and we start with the native myth. For given such a myth, Mr. Frost says, to raise the question of motive would be to undermine the matter discussed in advance. As the earlier play, King Lear, surely demonstrates sufficiently, any conceivable rationalization is bound to be weak and inadequate. This argument, in brief, states that the basic situation in King Lear is contrived. It goes back several centuries. Coleridge, for example, argued that Lear is the only serious performance of Shakespeare, the interests and situations of which are derived from the assumption of a gross improbability. He went on to say that the tragedies of Beaumont and Fletcher were, almost all of them, founded on some out-of-the-way accident or exception to the general experience of mankind. Even the opening scene of King Lear, according to Coleridge, proved that Shakespeare was the greater dramatist. Yet it was an old story, rooted in the popular faith, a thing taken for granted already, and consequently without any of the effects of improbability. Secondly, it is merely the canvas for the characters and passions, a mere occasion for, and not in the manner of Beaumont and Fletcher, perpetually recurring as the cause and sine qua non of the incident and emotion. Coleridge was arguing that Shakespeare had to start his play somewhere, and that the old story was good enough for his purpose. Coleridge did not invent this rationalization. He was not the last to present it. Harley Granville Barker has spoken of the megalithic grandeur of the first scene and adds, its probabilities are neither here nor there. The dramatist may postulate any situation he has the means to interpret if he will abide by the logic of it hereafter. Mr. Frost, therefore, is in good company. But a look at only one of the versions of the old story, Geoffrey of Monmouth's The Story of the Paynim, shows that the decision to divide the Inch kingdom is far from improbable. And Dr. Wilfred Perret has traced the Lear story to 52 separate versions from Geoffrey down to the appearance of the old play in 1594. It is remarkable that all these versions differed only on small points. In Geoffrey of Monmouth's account, Lear feels tired with age. He wants his daughters, Gonorilla, Regal, and Cordelia, to marry such husbands as are fit to be advanced to the government with them. In Geoffrey's version, Lear asks his daughters which of them loves him most. The chronicler goes to some pains to render the story credible. There is no hint in Geoffrey's account that Lear's request for declarations of affection is made before the assembled court with an attendant possibility of humiliating rebuff. Indeed, Lear consults first with his nobility before he bestows his two other daughters upon the Dukes of Cornwall and Albania. He gives them as dowry half the island and promises after his death to leave the whole monarchy of Britain as their inheritance. Lear's decision may be deplorable, but in Geoffrey's chronicle, it is not the act of a senile man. The old story, as Shakespeare found it, offered him a good deal, and he moved toward an even firmer sense of psychological realism as he made his changes in the original. We know that Eugen and Goneril are both aware of their father's unpredictability. They are cynically conscious that Lear has acted rashly, even when in full possession of his powers, and that he will probably behave badly now that he is old. Goneril speaks of the likelihood that Lear will be consistent in his foolishness. You see how full of changes his age is. The observation we have made of it has not been little. Goneril and Regan also know that Cordelia is Lear's favorite. They knew this before the time announced for the division of the kingdom. After Cordelia has fallen from grace, Goneril says, with some satisfaction, "She always loved our sister most." The rivalry between Cordelia and the two sisters must be accounted a definite factor in the kinds of speeches which all of them deliver to Lear. So this hyperbole of Goneril and Regan is directed not only to Lear's credulous ear, but against Cordelia, their hated rival. The unpredictability of Lear's conduct has been known to the kingdom for some time. However, neither Kent nor Gloucester expresses disapproval of Lear's intention, which is already announced, to surrender the land. Rather, they are concerned with the question whether Lear prefers the Duke of Albany to the Duke of Cornwall. Moreover, Gloucester, who is the second speaker of the scene, seems to know the exact division that Lear will publish in the throne. Lear desires to appear as the great king. He knows that he can surprise an audience of lords, and he delights in the prospect. The third king. He knows that he can surprise an audience of lords, and he delights in the prospect. The ceremony has been announced, but many details have been left obscure for purposes of effect. The sense of power to withhold or to bestow is very real to him, but its arbitrary nature is already notorious in the kingdom. Thus, all knew that the kingdom was to be divided, and some even knew how. Lear's statement before the assembled court, "Meantime we shall express our darker purpose," was not announced for the first time, the fact of his abdication. He plans in advance to assign to Cordelia a third more opulent than her sisters will receive. But his poor judgment, on which Goneril comments later, has prevented him from taking others into his confidence. He plans, as we know, to set his rest on Cordelia's kind nursery, to give her the most opulent share of the kingdom, to live with her permanently. He never intended or desired to alternate his home among the residences of his three daughters. Such a cycle involving the movement of 100 knights would have been dreary and endless. This plan of Lear's collapses when Cordelia, answering nothing to his demands for open affection, provokes the crisis. The situation of King Lear is, in some ways, the same as that which fascinated Thomas Merton and Thomas Chatfield, members of Queen Elizabeth's First Parliament. And Lear, like Gorboduc, was abdicating the responsibilities of monarchy for reasons that, however understandable, were bound to horrify the spectators. First among the reasons given by Lear was, of course, hedonism. Know that we have divided in three our kingdom. It is our fast intent to take all cares and business from our age, conferring them on younger strength while we, unburdened, crawl towards death. Lear has reached a venerable age. He believes that he deserves a rest. But his rationale, given in this speech, prefigures, in an interesting way, the bitter attacks on mere pleasure and irresponsible conduct that will be made later in the play. The second reason was given by both Gorboduc and Lear. It was certainly plausible to Elizabethan, who was concerned with the problem of the Queen's successor. It is, in brief, the desire to avoid a war of succession. If Lear can publish now the news of his daughter's dowry and notify the world of their extent and value, he believes that he can manage to prevent a bitter clash among Albany, France, Cornwall, and Burgundy. France and Burgundy are waiting, even at the moment, to learn what Cordelia's dowry will be. It is likely that, even without a division of the kingdom, some announcement on this matter will have to be made. Something could also be said for the possibility that Lear, from his own point of view, is acting as a statesman, as a peacemaker, and that he is trying to be generous to all parties involved. The third reason given by Lear sets up the conditions of the tragedy. Lear, in his desire to hear praise of himself, has elevated a family relationship to an affair of state. Tell me, my daughter, since now we will divest us both of rule, interests of territory, cares of state, which of you, shall we say, doth love us most, that we our largest bounty may extend where nature doth his merit challenge? Lear's action may be rash, but it speaks of king. We have seen his imperial power, his coronet. We have heard him command Gloucester to attend the King of France and the Duke of Burgundy. We have listened to his strong imperial vocabulary. Give me the map there. Know that we have divided. He accepts and receives instant obedience. When Goneril flatters him shamelessly, he awards her the first scepter of the kingdom. To the great generosity of a king, proud of the goodness of his gift, he does not enumerate the deer in the forest, or the kinds of crops which the field can raise. When Regan's flight of rhetoric follows, he behaves with equal magnanimity. The old play, The Chronicle History of King Lear, offered an additional reason for the division of the kingdom. The reason is not weak, it is not inadequate. The queen had but recently died. She was still being mourned. When King Lear came to the realization that he was constitutionally and temperamentally unable to take care of his daughter, he would have assumed responsibility for sons had he any. But he was already so old that he knew he could never have any more children. For this reason, he arranged to marry off his daughters, giving to them equal shares, no more, no less, but even all alike, and thinking upon the welfare of his soul. Shakespeare rejected, as well as accepted, aspects of his original source. The humanizing references to a much-loved queen but recently interred, and to a widower's bafflement over the raising of three daughters, would have distracted the spectator's attention from the full majesty of Lear at the moment of the partition of the kingdom. A Lear who would not play favorite among his daughters was likewise hard to conceive. For Shakespeare, Lear's prejudices rendered Lear vulnerable to the deceit of Goneril and Regan. Lear had to be peremptory and egocentric during this scene. How different he would seem in Act 1, Scene 1, if he expressed even once a concern with his own spiritual purification and with the afterlife. The fact that Lear is without male issue, hence, is so obvious that Shakespeare chooses neither to stress it in any explicit speech, nor to invoke our sense of pity for an old man burdened by the family problem of successful marriages for three daughters. The playwright's concern is, rightly, with the fifth establishment of character, Lear's pride, Cordelia's integrity, Kent's forthrightness, and the hypocrisy of Goneril and Regan. Characters must act. They operate within a situation. Shakespeare had inherited the situation from previous papers of the legend, but he did not regard the division of the kingdom as an inherently fantastic fact. We cannot know what he thought, but he clearly did more than any of his predecessors to rationalize and to make the division credible. Lear's behavior may be startling to us and to previous generations of critics, but Lear had important reasons for wanting to bestow dowries on his daughters before his death. His autocratic demeanor did not make us forget that his reasons, as given, are not those of a senile fool of infirm and tolerant years. The smutty-minded remark of Gloucester, which opened the play, had done much to establish the anti-nature motif. If a father can reject his son with as great an indifference as Gloucester rejects Edmund, another father may reject his daughter. Nor should we forget that the evil of Goneril and Regan is so monstrously, paralyzingly pure that Lear may be forgiven for not immediately perceiving its quality or dimension. Of the assembled court, only Cordelia, who grew up with her sisters, understands its nature. The division of the kingdom then has about it a need of inevitability, an understanding of what Shakespeare is doing with the given data will enrich what may well be the most fully written scene to play out for the theater.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You didn't take it much time to get alive even. This is a very strange method of raising people, but it isn't a close cooperation. I'll now call upon Mr. John L. Summer, a friend of Clay Peter Parish from Cornwall, who will speak on the Elizabeth Taylor and Ralph Jones in the portfolio.
Winter's Tale, of all the plays in the French folio, has been an easy provocative history, mainly with respect to its position in the 1623 publication. Scholars such as J.D. Wilson, Theresa Sanders, and E.E. Willoughby have carefully studied the case, pursuing it from various standpoints. For example, Wilson observed that, quote, the Winter's Tale looks as if it merely got left out of the volume altogether, end quote. His ultimate conclusion rests upon the following facts. 1. The drama occurs last in the folio under the heading of comedy. 2. It is printed on 2 squares of paper, each bearing its own special signature. 3. There is a blank page at the beginning and at the end. 4. It was re-registered by Sir Henry Herbert, Master of the Revels, because, quote, the allowed book is missing, end quote. Bruce Cade Chambers supports R.T. Rhodes' theory that the tenor copy of the Winter's Tale was taken from an assembled text of the play, calling attention to the peculiar stage direction contained therein as evidence for his contention. But perhaps the most ingenious study of this play has been conducted by E.E. Willoughby in attempting to determine the sequence of events leading to the publication of the first folio. Willoughby has concluded that the Winter's Tale was printed sometime in May, 1623. Furthermore, he suggests that King John and a portion of Richard II, the first two plays in the following history section of the folio, were printed before the Winter's Tale. In other words, he believes that the Winter's Tale was omitted from the initial printing of the comedy section of the folio, but was inserted at a later date. Inasmuch as Willoughby built his case in part around a memorandum from Sir Henry Herbert's office book, it is necessary that I repeat the contents of this document. Quote, to the King's play, an old play called Winter's Tale, formerly allowed of Sir George Buck, and likewise by me on Mr. Hemming, his word that there was nothing profane added or reformed, though the allowed book was missing. And therefore I return it without a fee this 19th of August, 1623, end quote. First, Willoughby acknowledged that the Winter's Tale was allowed by Herbert in August, 1623. 3 months, he contends, after the play had been printed in the folio. He even suggested that, quote, it may have been the printed piece of this play to put to the folio that Herbert returned without a fee and marked with his life, end quote. However, I do not think that Willoughby fully comprehended the many implications of this document. For example, when one further realizes that Isaac Judge and Edward Blunt later had the same play, along with others in the folio, registered for publication in the Stationery Company on November 8, 1623, he discovers that this situation constitutes an as yet unsolved problem in the Winter's Tale, and in the remaining portions of this paper I shall offer solutions. At the beginning, I must return to Sir Henry Herbert's memorandum. It tells us that the Playhouse Company was the King's play, and that the play is the Winter's Tale. Moreover, we learn that the same play had previously been licensed by Sir George Buck, Herbert's predecessor, and that it was now allowed again by Sir Herbert on the 19th of August, 1623. And you note that John Hemming is a representative of the King's Players who also vouched to the new copy. Let us now briefly consider the events leading up to the printing of the Winter's Tale in the first folio. We are certain of 3 things. 1, that the required copy was apparently missing and needed by the printer. 2, that the original allowed copy is missing. And 2, that the play is eventually printed in the first folio. Obviously, the major question to arise from these observations is, why was the play missing when it was needed for printing? Allow me to offer the following possible solutions. 1, the King's Players had overlooked or had misplaced their copy of the Winter's Tale. 2, the King's Players refused to part with their copy of the play because, as Herbert tells her, their allowed book is missing, their only source being the
player's part, or the plot, or both. 3. The play had been put into print, according to Willoughby, in May of 1623, but the manuscript from which the type was set, the Elabris, had been lost. At the present, I am in print for the last two possibilities and can detect a twofold implication. First, the King's players may have been reluctant to part with the only remaining officially licensed copy of the play. We know that as late as 1619, the Winter Shell had been performed, and this information emphasizes the fact that, at least by 1619, the King's players were in possession of the allowed book. We have adequate reason, therefore, to suggest at least that the allowed book may have been lost sometime after this date, unless the King's players performed the drama without the licensed copy. Secondly, the printer himself may have found it unwise to accept types from an unlicensed copy. Indeed, were the original copy of the play lost, he may have found it entirely impossible to accept types for the play at all. Assuming for the moment that the allowed copy of the Winter's Tale were lost prior to the printing of the folio, the publisher and printer would have had need of the work of a professional scrivener, whose job would have been to reconstruct a new copy of the play from Playhouse documents, which the King's players held in their possession. I think that this may have been the case. Therefore, Willoughby's story about the delayed printing of the Winter's Tale may eventually depend upon three subsequent actions. 1. Those concerned with the printing of the folio did not realize that the Winter's Tale was missing until the comedy session had been completed. 2. The scrivener himself required more time for the preparation of his manuscript than had been anticipated. 3. The scrivener who could prepare such a document was a difficult person to find. Let us for a moment return to the relicensing aspect of this problem. Assuming that a scrivener did prepare a new text of the play, is it not likely that Henry, a member of the King's players, as well as co-publisher of the first folio, would have desired to register this new copy with the Master of Revels, in lieu of the fact that the previously allowed book is missing? It seems increasingly clear that a new copy of the Winter's Tale was the one which Sir Herbert recorded in his memorandum of August 19, 1623, and thus the issue would seem to rest in the detection of a hand of a professional scrivener in the folio text of the play. In 1625, Ralph Crane, scrivener, published a second edition of his poem, The Works of Mercy. In the preface to this poem, one discovers an interesting passage which reads as follows. Quote, "In some form that hath my youthful pen had multiple civil, well-deserving men, that grace of state is honor and delight, of these two honesties I much should write. The wilsome prize is a cast of gold under the king of service, will be whole." End quote. Herein, Ralph Crane tells us that he has worked as a scrivener to the king's players, and scholars have long known that Crane made a transcription of Sir John Van Vaudeville in 1619 to the king's men. In addition, they know that in 1625, when the great plague struck London, Crane was reduced to poverty, at which time in his career, we find him dedicating personal transcriptions of poems and plays to numerous patrons in hopes of financial relief. One such transcription was Demetrius Andronicus. The interesting point about this document is that the king's men gave Ralph Crane the right to copy this play. For evidently, he was in favor with his company in 1625, and had earlier been co-favored by them in 1619. Is it not likely, then, that he may have been the chief scrivener during these years? And if true, may he not have been the man who could play the text of the Winter's Tale for printing in the 1623 folio? The answer lies in study of strange telegraphic traits and other touching in the folio edition of this play. I shall approach this problem with the following knowledge of Crane's hand. 1. The legibility of his hand and the neatness of his copy. 2. His avoidance and also his use of contraction. 3. His preference for colloquialism. 4. His orthographic habits. 5. His manner of punctuation involving the hyphen, apostrophe, and parentheses. 6. His division of plays into acts and scenes. 7. His skill in reconstructing plays from actors' parts and from plots. 8. His handling of stage directions. First, the neatness and orderliness of the manuscript and the subsequent effect upon the tenor text of the play. Crane wrote with an impeccable accuracy, and his hand would have presented few, if any, reading problems in the manuscript. Therefore,
If trained transcription were followed by Davis and Positive in the folio, the printed text should be free from transcribable type of error, as in the usual one is paired. Secondly, Strange attitude toward contractions and colloquialism. Under these categories, we may associate specific words with Strange transcription. For example, he commonly expanded the contractions I apostrophe M and apostrophe T-I-S to I-N and it is. However, occasionally he did write I-T apostrophe S for apostrophe T-I-S. He was also prone to write H A apostrophe A or H apostrophe A for has and E M for then. In the Winner's Tale, I T apostrophe S occurs 6 times, it is 3 times, apostrophe C I S 45 times, I M 42 times, I apostrophe M no times, H A apostrophe S 22 times, E M twice. This evidence, except for apostrophe T-I-S, points to Strange's hand in the transcription. Thirdly, the matter of Strange's orthography. It is at once interesting and complex. Briefly, Strange favored Y-S over I-S, with the latter form is impaired exclusively in the Winner's Tale. However, the spelling of such a swollen commonly in the S might easily have been recast by the compositor, almost without thought. On the other hand, in such words as he, she, and we, Strange used only one E. In the Winner's Tale, one find that me with a single E was used 178 times, me with a double E 12 times, me with a single E 70 times, me with a double E 14 times, me with a single E 121 times, me with a double E 29 times, me with a single E 120 times, me with a double E 11 times. He with a single E 70 times, he with a double E 20 times. Herein the evidence is overwhelming in favor of Strange. Next, Strange use of parentheses. The Winner's Tale contains an abundant use of these marks, with approximately 260 of these telltale marks appearing throughout the play. Indeed, there are three examples of the use of parentheses within parentheses. In the six ways in which Strange employed the hyphen, there are the following to be found in the Winner's Tale. For example, there are 50 uses of the metrical or emphasis hyphen in the drama. For example, watery star, watery hyphen star, or inch, pit, knee deep, inch hyphen stick, knee hyphen deep. The verb plus preposition hyphen appears 14 times. Will come on very slowly. Will come hyphen on very slowly. The use of the hyphen to link an object to a verb is also prevalent. He has made me 420 nosegays. He has made hyphen me 420 nosegays. In addition, miscellaneous anomalies occur over 100 times. By low you, by low hyphen you, or was he employed by him? He hyphen employed by him. This evidence undoubtedly constitutes a strong indication of Strange's hand in the Winner's Tale. Next, Strange's division of a play into acts and scenes. In the Winner's Tale, the first act is divided 2 times, the second 3 times, the third 3 times, the fourth 4 times, and the fifth 3 times. When one recalls that no previous printed edition of this play existed prior to the folio, he realizes that the folio text must have been set from a copy which was co-divided. The Winner's Tale is arbitrarily dated 1610. However, the first play to have been divided into acts, the second Lady's Tragedy, came out of Piazza 1611, and Bonneville, a sound transcription, was not divided into acts and scenes until 1619. Hence, there is good reason to think that Shakespeare was not responsible for the acting division of the play, and that were scribal fair copies prepared from his original document, that likewise would not have been co-divided. Therefore, one concludes that the acting division of the folio version of this play, and by indirection present in the transcription used in 1623 for the folio, was the work of a scribe. Such evidence is indeed strongly indicative of Ralph Strange's work, and it follows naturally that a study compositor would have adhered to the transcription containing these divisions. Furthermore, The fact that there are other plays in the 1623 quarter which do not contain such provisions leads one to think that it's impossible is not the individual responsible for such a harm as the text of the winner's tale. Next, the stage directions in the play. Crane had four major penalties concerning stage directions. First, he often failed to record them at all. Therefore, if he did copy, were placed in advance of a logical position in the play, and or were generally written for what one might call a literary play. Finally, he preferred to list all of the characters in the scene prior to the opening of that scene. His last attempt is known as marking the characters. In the Winner's Tale, a 15-scene play, there are only seven directions, which are exclusive of the common international designation. Moreover, all seven possess a distinct literary flavor, as the well-known following example will verify, quote, "Exit received by bear," end quote. Furthermore, there are three instances of advanced stage directions. For example, the crowning shepherd enter with a direction marking the scene four lines before the crown called upon the speak. Also, Corazel, Pedita, and others enter as directed some 16 lines early. In addition, 13 of the 15 scenes in the play are defeated by Maximus' character. The final step in this inquiry concerns the possible assembling of the play from the actor's parts in the plot. Archie Ball has called our attention to Crane's transcription of a Gimlet's text as an assembled text, showing conclusively that Crane is capable of such an endeavor. Let us now examine the so-called stage plot, briefly. This document provided an outline of the play, quote, "with occasional notes of action," end quote, and is placed backstage for all to control. In this document, all instances and metrics were marked, and in it all scenes were outlined. And lastly, the characters of the scene were cataloged before the opening of the scene. It is obvious that the division of action scenes and the marking of characters to be detected in the Winner's Tale may be related to the possibility of a stage plot in the transcription of a new copy. I'm convinced that the formal text of this play, that is the Tennant copy, is an assembled text prepared by Ralph Crane, similar to the King's name. In conclusion, we have seen that the Winner's Tale was printed in the 1623 folio from a Crane new copy, the result of Ralph Crane's transcription, as a careful study of telegraphic chemistry seems to demonstrate. But let us briefly reconstruct the situation. It would now appear that Ralph Crane is employed by someone, probably Henry, to prepare a new copy of the Winner's Tale. It follows next that Crane must have made his transcription from the actor's part and stage plot, inasmuch as Sir Herbert's memorandum tells us that the allowed book is missing. And it is indeed furthermore, and it is likely furthermore, that the King's players would have been appropriately grateful to have a relicensed copy of this play. However, I still admit that there are problems yet to be resolved about the Winner's Tale and Ralph Crane's share in its transcription. For example, what did happen to the original or allowed licensed copy? And did Ralph Crane perform similar tasks to Henry and Tom Dale with respect to other plays by Shakespeare in the preparation of the 1623 folio?
Thank you very much. We have 10 minutes of the discussion, and I have a strong feeling that we are running ahead of the people next day. I want to ask a question of the last speaker. What was the full name of this licensor company, something called it? Well, I'm not going to prepare. I think you can call it Governor Orbit, you can call it Governor. And if you are very intimate, you can call him, that's the one who is right for it. And then my focus, the meeting is now open for questions which you can address directly to the person who's directly.